This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Greg Merriweather, WAFB reporter. We'll talk with him about many things, including the George Zimmerman verdict over the weekend and whether people in Louisiana will be as revved up as some folks are in other parts of the country. Greg Merriweather, 12 years now as a reporter for Channel 9. Also on the show, Andrea Carroll, LSU law professor. She says Governor Jindal misused his veto authority during the last session, and during the last regular session, lawmakers were not happy either, at least some, but not enough to have a veto session. And we'll talk with Professor Andrea Carroll about the governor's decisions to veto some measures. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It is 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We begin with Greg Merriweather, WAFB anchor and reporter. He's been with Channel 9 now for almost a dozen years. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning to you, Jim. Thank you very much for having me.
And you're still a young man, but you've spent 12 years here, and you've covered many interesting stories through the years.
Well, I came here with a full head of hair, and now you see what I have. So for your audience, there's not much up there.
Well, I recall when you first came here, the serial killer story was the big story that was permeating as far as crime, and that was your beat at the time. In fact, You're Mr. Street Beat.
Right. Yeah, I've always said I was born Greg Merriweather, but in Baton Rouge, I will for sure die Street Beat. That just was my moniker and something that was a big part of my career, still is a big part of my career, although we don't do the segment anymore. The serial killer case was something that just literally gripped Baton Rouge. I mean, it crossed all lines, socioeconomic lines. It really affected people right where it hurts. And it was just something that I think put a lot of eyes on television sets. And it's something that we were talking about just the other day that I don't think would have happened in these days with Facebook and Twitter. I think the word would have gotten out more. I think people would have been a lot more aware of their surroundings and things. He was still getting into homes, even at the height of this, that were unlocked and people opening doors for him.
Right. Well, you were covering that story with Ernest every day. And Greg, of course, was a street beat for many years. And then he evolved into an anchor. And I guess that's your primary duty now. Many reporters, many, not all, but many strive to be anchors. That's usually the most high-profile position at a television station. No, you have any preference as far as one or the other?
I'm kind of old school, and I just like to be a storyteller, basically. So whatever role that is, and it doesn't necessarily have to be an on-air role always. You know, I can tell good stories behind the scenes and write stories for people or write different material that needs to go on the air that necessarily might not have my face on it. It's good to go out there and gather the news. And I mean, I really look back at it as almost like a town crier. Like, you're the person that gets to go to the top of the mountain and yell what's going on. It just so happens Channel 9 has the tallest mountain so far, and so we've been lucky with that.
Well, the story that has captivated the country, captured the attention of America and even international news, is the George Zimmerman verdict and the trial, and before that the reporting about the murder. If it was a murder, it was a shooting. We know that. And the Justice Department says it's looking into the shooting death of Trayvon Martin to determine whether federal prosecutors will now file criminal civil rights charges with George Zimmerman acquitted in Florida in the state case. Your thoughts about why this story has generated the kind of attention it has, Greg?
I think, unfortunately, politics got in the middle of this story. It's a tragedy for both families. I mean, you have one family lost a child, another family who will never be the same, that is, fortunately for him, still alive and able to move around. But I don't think that politics or even our national interest really needed to play a role in this. I think it put pressure on the prosecutors. I think it put pressure on that community there. And I just don't see where that probably helped the situation at all. We've had several cases not similar to the merits of that one here in Baton Rouge, but we've had cases where politics get involved, and that tends to not play well with the justice system. The justice system was not set up for that type of thing, and obviously we've had plenty of crime going on down here that never made national news that you sometimes wonder where was the Jesse Jacksons, where was Al Sharpton you know, when we had a guy now accused of being Boosie's hitman, killing five people, and at least being convicted of one of those, and admitting to several others at different times and taking it back. But you wonder, where was the outrage in some of the communities then when we have something like that going on?
So what do you think the politics were in this particular case?
I think race. I think race played a big part in it. I think people automatically assumed, and that's a South thing, that it's a black and white issue where he turned out to be a Hispanic male and a black male. But I think once you get race involved in these things, oftentimes you start getting different groups on either side lining up. You know, as soon as one gets in, the other gets in, and then that's where we lose track of what actually happened there. I think most people can't separate it from the confrontation, which we know no one knows what happened except for him, Zimmerman, and Trayvon Martin. No one knows what happened between them but them. And that's what made this one so tough.
Trayvon Martin's not around to disclose what happened. Right. But there have been cases involving blacks and whites that have been covered and others that have not. And I can cite one in 1956, March 26, George Eames, a former civil rights leader in this community. He was shot by a white man after dark in a segregated neighborhood, and an all-white DA's office concluded a year and a half later that Mr. Eames was merely walking down the street when he was shot, paralyzed for life. That story didn't generate any kind of local attention, much less national attention. In fact, the next day, this is 1956, Greg, before you were born and before even I was born, it said that a Baton Rouge marksman had scored a bullseye. And so we've come a long ways in race relations, but stories like this are just magnets for the kind of attention that permeates throughout the country. Do you think it was warranted, the kind of coverage this particular story garnered?
I think it was definitely warranted, the coverage, because people watched it overwhelmingly and people read it overwhelmingly. I mean, we got hard numbers to back that up. The issue is, and it kind of comes to where your heart is in politics, is people say they don't like negative news, they don't like bad things, but they do. I mean, the whole reason why our Street Beat became one of the most successful franchises we've ever had was because, I mean, we weren't reporting all a bunch of good news on there. We were showing mugshots and showing where the shootings happened. People not necessarily enjoy bad news, but they watch it and it gets their attention. Mm-hmm. And when in politics, what I brought that up for was, it's people say they don't like negative ads, but they do. You know, they watch them.
Quite often you would put a microphone in some of these assailants or alleged assailants' faces, and they would recognize you and refer to you as Street Beat.
Right. Yeah. We definitely had that happen a number of times.
Louise on Old Perkins. Louise, you're on the air with Greg Merriweather, WAFB anchor and reporter. Hi, Louise.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. I followed the local radio, TV broadcast, and Greg is undoubtedly outstanding. I think his comments that he just made about politics getting involved in all this is so true. And he really puts a good perspective on his reporting, and we're very fortunate to have him in Baton Rouge. And that's really what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Louise. I'm sure Greg's appreciative of your remarks.
Thank you very much, Louise. My mom would be proud.
297-5633. HB in Denham Springs, you're on WRKF with Greg Merriweather. Hi, HB.
Good morning. Mr. Greg, I'd like to get your opinion on a question that's in my mind. Have we become a nation or a society in general with a fixation for lawsuits at all levels, even including your profession that you have to guard so much against how you report and what you report and what you say? Thank you, sir.
That's a very good point, and I believe that we are very, very fixated on that type of thing. I mean, if you watch Channel 9, you see all the lawyer commercials. Of course, that pays a lot of the salaries at Channel 9, but I mean, because it's advertising. But we've definitely had to watch what we do, and part of it kind of keeps us on our toes, but some of it can sometimes be distracting. Sometimes we're not able to necessarily get out what we need to get out because of a fear of a lawsuit or something like that. And not as far much as stories, though. If there's a story, never ran into an issue where we said, nah, we might get sued over that, let's not do it. Where we would worry about it is, you know, are we 100% right? Are we not going to drag somebody's name through the mud that might have a legitimate cause against us. So I think that it's always something that plays in the back of our minds, and it's one of those things to where that definitely is a generational thing, because I'm sure in my parents' generation it was nowhere near that, as far as just everybody was ready to just sue on a drop of a hat. But sometimes it's
well. We've had John Camp from WBRZ on this show, and in his day he was a lone ranger out there as an investigative reporter. That was all he did. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't that be nice?
Right.
Nice for the community and nice for the reporter.
Right. And he probably had plenty of things to cover back then, as he probably would nowadays. It's probably some of it gets...
Well, in this area, it always seems like there's something to cover, and crime, of course, is a big part of that. One story that has been perhaps underreported, the Advocate made note of it, but at least for the first half of the year, the murder rate in Baton Rouge is down significantly. So that's progress. Whether it'll continue, we don't know, but at least it seems like the trend is going in the right direction for the first time in a while.
I've always had an issue with murder rate reporting, and I've probably done over a dozen of them in my time in Baton Rouge, because it's hard to compare one year to another year to me. You can do it with numbers, but each case, there's something going on. I mean, if I have an angst against you and I want to take you out, I can find you and do that. It has nothing to do with what somebody did this time, by this time last year, on a numbers-wise game. But we report those to kind of show some perspective, but I think you have to also look in those numbers and realize that, I mean, you just can't change some of these situations. We had one year where we were reporting numbers, and it was Anthony Bell. He had went into a church and shot, you know, seven people. It was like, you know, that right there skews the numbers, and we were always going against those. And so I think we run into an issue with that, but I think any time we can say that the numbers are down, it would probably be a good thing.
Well, and on a consistent basis,
right.
Baton Rouge has far more murders than, say, San Francisco does, which has far more people. And this is year after year after year after year. So when we look at it from that perspective, I think we've obviously got an issue here.
Honestly, a lot of those, Jim, too, are you can classify them, and we have the hard numbers. You can put that between a 17- and a 34-year-old black male. It's either the victim or the perpetrator in almost in a great majority of those cases, and specifically in the city limits of Baton Rouge. And I think that's an issue that really needs to be looked at. I would like to see, when we have these groups and things being politicized, I would like to see them come in and talk about that and raise awareness about that, why we have so many black males committing these crimes and why we have so many black males being victims in these crimes.
297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Dr. Albert Samuels at Southern University. Good morning, Dr. Samuels. You're on the air.
Good morning, Jim, and good morning, Greg, Mr. Speakbeat. I want to make a comment. I want to try to say this carefully because I don't want to be misunderstood. A point was made earlier that politics got in the way, and as if to... And I don't know if this is what was meant by this, but it sort of implied or seemed to imply that it shouldn't have been a factor. You know, and when the national spotlight ended up on Sanford, Florida, people need to remember that it was the local people in Sanford who actually reached out to some national figures, you know, like the Al Sharpton's and what have you, and because they said that what happened in the Trayvon Martin case was not an isolated incident, but there had been a systemic problem with the Sanford Police Department.
All right, hold on, Dr. Samuels. We're going to go to a break, but as we head there, I want Greg to respond if he wishes.
Yes, well, I'll say this. If that is the case, then we hardly heard that at all. All we did was focus on this one particular instance. If it's been a systemic problem with the Sanford Police Department, that got lost in the politics.
297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757. We'll spend a bit more time with WAFB's Greg Merriweather. Baton Rouge, by the way, has a law, because it's in the state of Louisiana, that's quite similar to that of Florida as far as stand your ground, and that was what enabled George Zimmerman to be found not guilty of the killing of Trayvon Martin. We'll talk more when we return after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, your number. A few more minutes with Greg Merriweather, WAFB anchor and reporter. Greg grew up in the great city of Louisville. He's been in Baton Rouge for the last 12 years as a reporter and an anchor, and we're talking about the death of Trayvon Martin and the not guilty verdict in the George Zimmerman trial. Today, the New York Times says it may not be possible to consider the case of George Zimmerman, who was acquitted Saturday of all charges in the killing of Trayvon Martin, as anything but a sad commentary on the state of race relations and the battle over gun rights in America. Certainly, it's about race. Ask any black man, up to and including President Obama, and he will tell you at least a few stories that sound eerily like what happened that rainy winter night in Sanford, Florida. Anything ever happened to you growing up or since like this?
No, never had any issue like that. I've had issues with where I would perceive to be a race issue. I had a unique experience. My mom's white and my dad's black. I grew up in a suburb of Louisville, so it's always been obviously something that I wear around, but I had a unique experience in the fact is I saw the best of both sides. I mean, my mom's family, my dad's family, both great people involved there. And I got both cultures, at least got to experience both cultures growing up. So it's always given me what I believe to be a unique perspective.
Dr. Samuels, I didn't want to cut you short. You're still there, I hope.
Yes, actually, I'm still here.
Okay.
I think one of the reasons why this case resonated so deeply especially among black Americans is that so many black men and actually black women, especially black mothers, could see themselves in Trayvon Martin. They have had experiences like this. This has happened to me. I've been stopped by the police or had the police called on me when I wasn't doing anything wrong. I remember as a college student, I was doing door-to-door sales one time, and of course, I wasn't very good at it, as it turned out. But I was minding my own business, and a lady came storming out of the house, and she said, "I thought you were about to steal my car." And all I was doing was drawing a map of the house that I was about to visit. But she assumed it didn't matter that I was a college student and was well dressed. I wasn't dressed in a hoodie or whatever was the end thing at that time. But she just assumed because I was black, I had no right to be in that neighborhood. So many black people, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what your educational status is. I mean, Henry Louis Gates a few years ago was arrested and was basically because he was accused by the Cambridge police of breaking into his own house. And one of his neighbors called the police on him and said, "A strange man is outside that house across the street." That was his house.
Doctor, I think what that does for me is it just brings up the fact, and I think it's a sad commentary on the way our country is at this point. You can call off the two instances you said there. You can remember specific details about them. You remember what their names were, I mean, who their names are. I mean, you remember all of that, what police departments are involved in. You remember a lot of details with those cases because they got so much attention. We're not putting, I believe, sometimes enough attention on the regular crime, if you will, that happens when we have so many different young African-American men killed on the streets of Baton Rouge. That, to me, where are those names? Where are those instances and street names? I do this for a living and can't recall a lot of them, the different shootings we had last year. And those are just as important as any other death or any other attempted arrest over race. But where is the attention on those type of crimes? That's what I mean, we're talking about hundreds in one city, 500 in Chicago. I mean, where is the attention on that? If we take out the politics of the other situations, I don't believe they get as much attention. What do we need to do to get more attention on these, quote-unquote, street shootings?
You still there, Dr. Samuels?
Yeah. I think Greg just asked the $64,000 question. My question. You're right. It's probably going to require local efforts in a lot of these communities. I think if we wait for media, if you will, I don't mean this, in a bad way, but you know, it's not a mystery as to why the Trayvon Martin case garnered so much attention. You know, because you know it brings in all these narratives about, you know, about race and the criminal justice system and politics, and it's an intersection of all these things, and that pushes ratings. I guess we can't expect the media in sometimes to cover these things probably in the way that we want to. So I guess the people who care about these issues are going to have to just content themselves to working on these issues quietly and not look for the attention. And then eventually, if we start making a difference on that, maybe then finally the media will catch up to it.
All right. What do you think, Greg? Thank you, Dr. Samuels. What do you think, Greg, about the outrage that is obviously evident in the African American community from one end of America to the other about this verdict?
I think people are upset. I was proud to see that a great majority of the folks handled themselves correctly and maybe pushed to social media to get a lot of their concerns out versus riots in the streets or anything like that. That we saw with the Rodney King verdict many years ago, different case, but similar outrage. But I think if you sit down and have a conversation with even the people that are the most angry and describe to them what is going on and show them how maybe they should have went for a different charge, or, you know, you get down and give them the specifics of what happened, I think a lot of people come around to just being more calm about the situation.
Kenya in Sherwood. Kenya, please be brief. You're on with Greg Merriweather. Hi, Kenya.
I just want to say, when you look at the racial aspect of every single issue when it comes down to this, that doesn't really matter when you look at the loss of life. George Zimmerman is going to know how Trayvon felt. When you look at Dr. Martin Luther King, he wasn't killed based upon what people thought about and this and that. It's because of what he stood for. And it's the same thing that killed Trayvon Martin. Trayvon Martin was killed because who people thought he was. And that's the problem that a lot of people have in the society. We can't continue to judge each other based upon preconceived notions instead of sitting down and getting to understand each part of the culture.
All right. Is this a symbol of all kinds of other things in our country and in our society?
This is sometimes looking in the mirror and not being exactly happy with what you see.
Robert on O'Neill. Robert, good morning. Robert, you're on the air with Greg Merriweather.
Oh, yeah. Good morning, gentlemen. You know, everyone, Greg, I think, has anecdotal evidence that they can use to cite, you know, their biases as far as this case is concerned. And so I was wondering what you would think. Why didn't the young Caucasian man and his family that was assaulted at the gas station here in Baton Rouge receive anywhere close to the national attention that this Trayvon Martin case received?
That's a very good point. And in that case, one person was arrested. There were two other people involved in that fight, and they were not arrested. They were cited, but not taken to jail and booked. Obviously, nobody died in this case, but according to the district attorney, Hiller Moore, and I just had this conversation with him last week, he did get calls, at least, and emails from all across the country, people wanting a hate crime, people not wanting a hate crime. I think a lot of it died down when they, as I was talking about, looked at the actual merits of what happened and realized, Hiller Moore told me this, I can go after this, Donald Dickerson is his name, I can go after him under the hate crime penalty and try to enhance his sentence with that. Or I can use the habitual offender law. One would get him life in prison without the possibility of parole. One would just give him 5 years. So you kind of do the math there and figure out that the hate crime was not where they wanted to go, and that's what the victims decided they wanted to do. And I think once you take that out of it, then that's when that politics and that extra attention kind of goes right out of it. It becomes now just a case of second-degree battery, I believe, is the charge.
Joe on Bluebonnet. Good morning, Joe. You're on the air.
Thank you, Jim. Good morning to you, and good morning to Greg.
Morning, sir.
And I got one small question to ask. I know a person who is, in the eyes of everybody in the United States, is white. But if you say that they are white, they'll say they are Spanish. So that's back to that issue of race. Could you explain that, please?
You're talking about Zimmerman?
Yes.
All right.
I mean, you would have to talk with them and figure out. Trust me, coming from a biracial family, I've been called a lot of different things. I got my high school transcript when I graduated, and it said white male on it. So all 4 years, I was classified as a white male while I was there. So, and most people would not classify me as a white male if they saw me. So I think people choose to be who they are, and I'm okay with that.
All right. Well, Greg Merriweather, always a pleasure.
Thank you, sir.
Again soon, and
absolutely.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Take care. 297-5633 is your number, and we switch gears now, and we're joined by Andrea Carroll, professor of law at Louisiana State University. Received her degree in law in 2000 from the LSU Law Center. And Professor Carroll, good morning to you.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me today.
Well, you wrote a piece that got a lot of attention in various newspapers, a letter to the editor about Governor Jindal allegedly abusing his veto power. How did he do that?
Well, I am arguing that specifically with respect to his veto of Senate Bill 162, which was a gestational surrogacy bill that got a lot of attention in Louisiana, he abused the veto power for a number of reasons. First, because of the timing of it, the timing at which he chose to make the veto. Second, because of the subject matter of the veto. Mm-hmm. And third, because of the reasons he cited. So maybe we can talk about the timing first. That's been in the news a lot lately because of the possibility of the legislature calling for an override session. You know, the state constitution allows the governor to veto a bill if the legislature is in session within 10 days, if the legislature is out of session within 20 days. And what the governor did here with respect to the gestational surrogacy bill and a number of other bills, including the line item vetoes mm-hmm. of funding for the disabled, was waited until the very last day. The legislature is out of session, of course, at that time. And so people's natural reaction is, well, if you don't like the veto, just have the legislature override it. All we need is a two-thirds vote. The reality, though, that I don't think many people are aware of is that that requires the calling of an override session. It costs the state tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars, maybe $250,000 for a week, for instance. The reality is that that has never happened in modern history. The legislature has never voted because of the expense to call an override session. And so where the governor waits until the last minute to veto a bill, I think that's an abuse of the power that the Constitution confers upon him.
297-5633 is your number. Andy Carroll, LSU professor of law, saying Governor Jindal has abused his veto power, in particular regarding Senate Bill 162. So you're not really commenting on other vetoes, just this specific one.
Well, this is the one that I know the most about, of course, because I was the lead drafter of the bill on gestational surrogacy. But, you know, one that's gotten much more attention, of course, is the line item veto for funding for the disabled. Mm-hmm. I think for that reason, we came closer to having the legislature vote for a veto session this year than we ever have in modern history, fell shy by 6 votes. You need a majority vote in both the House and the Senate. The House did vote to have a veto mm-hmm. override session despite the expense, fell short by 6 votes in the Senate, which I think sort of highlights the problem. You know, vetoes have been overridden when the legislature is in session, but it's sort of odd that there would never have been a veto override out of session.
You say that he used the same language word for word that Chris Christie used in New Jersey and vetoing an identical bill.
Absolutely. The problem is that it didn't make much sense in Louisiana. What Chris Christie said in vetoing the New Jersey bill is that the legislature had not spent enough time considering the bill. In Louisiana, though, this was a bill propounded by the Louisiana State Law Institute, a body that considered this bill for 3 years. Put the bill in front of the best and brightest judges, lawyers, scholars in the state. Literally, I don't know how much more a bill could possibly have been considered. And so Governor Jindal borrowed Chris Christie's words and said that there was not much legislative consideration of the bill. That just wasn't true. in Louisiana. We can only wonder why he borrowed precisely the language that Chris Christie used in vetoing New Jersey bill.
I don't know if anybody's ever been accused of plagiarism for using the same language in a veto message, but you're saying that Chris Christie or somebody who wrote for Chris Christie probably was also doing the writing for Governor Jindal's.
I'm suggesting that there might be reasons other than that, you know, was a good message
in
Louisiana.
Could Chris Christie have written that piece for Politico? I don't know. 297-5633. Bruce and Walden. Bruce, you're on with Professor Andy Carroll, LSU School of Law. Hi, Bruce.
Yeah, hi, Jim. Thanks a lot. As a law professor, I just wanted you to comment on this. A number of us are considering an Olmstead lawsuit against Jindal's cutting of the waiver suits because it jeopardizes people, forces people into institutions and the like. So I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Sure, I will. I think people are sort of trying to find a number of ways to check the governor's power here, where it's become sort of absolute. Recall initiatives I've heard propounded, private suits, calling of override sessions. I think it's unlikely that any of those will be successful, unfortunately.
297-5633. Barbara Forrest of SLU says... please ask, which I'm doing, Professor Carroll to comment on the Louisiana Family Forum's involvement in the veto.
Yes, I think that's another problem with this veto specifically. It really surprised me that Governor Jindal, in his veto message, listed a number of specific public interest groups that he was vetoing for, essentially. Those included the Louisiana Family Forum, Louisiana Conference of Catholic Bishops, and a number of other groups. Surprising that a governor would specifically list the organizations that he's catering to. Louisiana Family Forum opposed this bill from the very beginning because they argued this is a group, of course, that touts itself as one who defends the traditional family in Louisiana. The Catholic bishops oppose the use of in vitro fertilization, even for a married couple that suffer from infertility. And so they argued this is not about the traditional family, husband and wife, procreating in the traditional way. And thus, they think that Louisianans shouldn't be able to use it. I think that's offensive. I found it offensive that the Family Forum tells us how we're allowed to create families.
297-5633. Now, Governor Jindal vetoed this bill, and even Melissa Flournoy, who heads Planned Parenthood in Louisiana, was on this show not so long ago, about a week ago, saying that there were some issues with the legislation. What were the primary issues?
Well, as the lead drafter of the legislation, obviously, I think it was pretty good and pretty strong. We vetted all the issues for 3 years. One issue that I would say that I had with the legislation that I hoped would change and did not, because Louisiana remains such a conservative state, is that it was limited to allowing a married couple, husband and wife, in Louisiana to use gestational surrogacy. And we heard a lot of argument that it should be broader. Anyone who wants to create a family in Louisiana should be able to do that, that it was discriminatory. Mm-hmm. I wish that we would have been able to come to a version that allowed single women to use it, that allowed gay couples to use it. We couldn't get that far in Louisiana.
It's somewhat remarkable the bill passed the legislature in the first place, but it was vetoed by Governor Jindal, and we'll talk more with Andy Carroll in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. LSU Law Professor Andy Carroll is with us, and she has acknowledged she was the person who wrote this surrogate mother bill for Louisiana, and it passed the legislature in a very conservative legislature, but was vetoed by the governor, and Andy Carroll says the governor was off base, in fact, abused his veto power. I would imagine it took quite a feat to get enough lawmakers to come aboard on this.
You know, we had much greater success than we even anticipated. I think that's yet another problem with the veto. This is a bill that had 90% of the legislators voting in favor of it, something that when we began, we really didn't think was possible. But the fact is, almost everyone knows a couple that suffered from infertility, a couple that wants to have a child, that would be a good family and is unable to do so. And so I think the legislators really recognize the need to allow people to create families in this manner, 90% voted for this bill, should have been veto-proof.
Well, it obviously was not. And if there had been a veto session, this would have been included.
One would think. You only need a two-thirds vote to override, so I would have been surprised if the veto wouldn't have been overridden. But alas, no session this time.
Yeah, but it was closer than many thought. The House actually voted for a veto session. The Senate missed by 6 votes. Albert Guillory, who was on the show Friday, did indicate after the show that he voted against having a veto session. And
I think there are a number of people that would have voted to override specific vetoes, not only this bill, but the funding for the disabled, some of the economic districts. But, you know, there would be an outcry if they voted, even by people that support specific legislation, to spend $250,000 of the state's money, of the taxpayers' money, in order to do this. And there are ways that we can reform the system that would prevent the spending of that much money and allow an override to be more possible. We need to do that as a check on the governor's power, because currently it's essentially become absolute.
What exactly would the bill have done?
The bill would have provided a legal framework for gestational surrogacy in Louisiana. Gestational surrogacy being an arrangement in which a woman agrees to carry a child to term for a married couple that provide genetic material for the child. Currently, that's legal. It's possible to use gestational surrogacy under Louisiana law, but there's absolutely no legal regulation of it. So, for instance, we don't have anything in the law saying who's the mother of the child. Is it the woman who gives birth? Is it the woman who creates the genetic material? What do we do in the event of a custody battle between the parents? We need a legal framework. Can money be paid in connection with this surrogacy? All those questions are unanswered under current Louisiana law, and this bill would have provided a legal framework for something that's already occurring in Louisiana and already legal in Louisiana.
How many other states have this kind of legislation on the
About 12 states have approved through legislation gestational surrogacy. About 15 more are silent, which means that they allow it, but they haven't legislatively approved it. Certainly the trend.
Any in the Deep South?
Florida. Yes, allows gestational surrogacy and has one of the best written gestational surrogacy laws in the country. We actually borrowed heavily from the Florida law in drafting this bill.
877-217-5757 or inkstershow@wrkf.org in our remaining time with Dr. Andrea Carroll. Dorothy on Goodwood. Dorothy, good morning. You're on with Dr. Carroll.
Good morning. Dr. Carroll, do you think we are ever going to get to a point in the state where a governor has so much power that a veto cannot be overridden?
I think we're there. That's precisely what I'm saying today, that the intent of the veto, at least as the framers conceived of it, was to be a qualified veto. It's for, obviously, a balance of powers, a check on the various branches of government. But here, when the governor vetoes out of session, it essentially makes that power absolute. You know, people would say, well, technically we could call for an override session, but it's just not practical. It's not going to happen. And it doesn't make sense for legislators to call for it where it would cost the state so much money. I think we are in the place where the governor's power here has become absolute. And that's why I'm here. I want us to think about other possibilities. We could force a veto earlier and to allow the legislature to consider an override. We could amend the Constitution to override the vote in the next session. There are other alternatives to provide a check, and we need to think about doing that now.
Well, as mentioned, Governor Chris Christie, in vetoing same kind of bill in New Jersey, said that profound change in the traditional beginnings of a family would be brought by the New Jersey bill, and Governor Jindal used the same language that Christie did in vetoing the New Jersey bill. So I would think that there's a strong possibility that Governor Jindal eyeballed the veto from his colleague in New Jersey.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think that's pretty clear. And I'm sure Chris Christie was pressured by religious, primarily Catholic groups there as well into vetoing the bill, which it's obvious from Jindal's veto message is what happened here.
Elise asks if your job at the law center is protected, or could the governor come after you, Andy Carroll?
Well, I'm a tenured full professor of law, but I suppose anything's possible. So maybe Jim will hire me if I find myself out of a job.
Well, Bob Mann, who's a tenured professor at the Manship School, is writing editorials ridiculing the governor. The latest in the Picayune yesterday, in which he says the governor's bid to become president is preposterous. I'm paraphrasing Mr. Mann, but it's not easy to criticize a governor. Or maybe it is.
Well, I think these days I'm in good company. Haven't seen any recent poll numbers after these vetoes, but I hear his approval rating is down to somewhere in the 30% range these days. So I'm not alone.
Well, Mann writes, Jindal's national campaign, it gets interesting. He doesn't realize it yet, but it will be a preposterous adventure. He will never be president because he's simply an awful candidate. Those words from Bob Mann. As I've noted here before, people laughed in Georgia at Jimmy Carter when he ran for president, and look what happened. Strange things can happen, and this governor, I think, wants to be president. Do you think those aspirations may have influenced this veto?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's the reason that I'm speculating, of course, but I don't know why he would have chosen to parrot Chris Christie's language, except that he wants to dance with Chris Christie. He can't
be
out-conservative.
Interesting couple.
Right. He can't be out-conservative by Chris Christie. He borrowed that language because he wanted to put himself on the same plane and be able to say next year that, he vetoed for the same reasons.
It's extremely rare, veto session or not, for a gubernatorial veto to be overridden. And sometimes lawmakers vote one way, and then when it comes time to override the governor, they end up saying, well, you know, mm-hmm. the governor might have a point for whatever reason. So you might have had a difficult challenge, but you would have liked to have seen what happened, I'm sure.
Exactly. I mean, and there have been, in the state's history, overrides of vetoes during the legislative session. It's happened twice in modern history, in recent times. There has never been an override that required a special session, and that's the problem.
How did it work? Did you have to go out and find a sponsor for this bill, or did the sponsor come to you?
Well, we were lucky enough in this bill to find Gary Smith, who we sort of came to him. He came to us. We knew, both of us knew, that the other was making efforts in this direction for a long time. Senator Smith has two children through gestational surrogacy. He's a proud Louisianian, but wasn't able to use Louisiana law to create his family. So he went to both California and New Mexico to create his family, and he wanted to, obviously this is a matter near and dear to his heart, he wanted to create a legal framework to protect families in Louisiana who choose to use surrogacy. So it was a wonderful fit for the Law Institute to have someone who believed so wholeheartedly in the bill. We were happy to have that.
So how does that work when somebody has to go out of state?
They're allowed to do that. They're allowed to go out of state, and we will recognize the creation of that family inside Louisiana as soon as they return to Louisiana. But it forces Louisiana citizens, Louisiana families, to travel to California, travel to Nevada, undergo procedures there. When gestational surrogacy, again, is legal in Louisiana, we just don't provide the necessary legal framework.
Well, the governor, you said you'd like to see this available to same-sex couples. The governor is, of course, against that, saying he's a defender of traditional marriage. Mm-hmm. I would imagine you would take issue with him on issues beyond this particular legislation.
Well, absolutely. On that point, though, the Louisiana legislature sided with the governor. The legislature wasn't willing to extend the bill yet to same-sex couples. So we're not there in any branch of government.
Would you be
quite
involved
yet
in legislation of that kind?
Yes, absolutely. I would have liked to have seen that legislation go in this direction in the first place, but we knew that it wouldn't get passed in that form. And I want to underscore again the desperate need for some legal regulation of surrogacy here. We're flying blind. We've got absolutely nothing. And so we needed to get some regulation first and then perhaps broaden it to other couples, other families later.
Mm-hmm. Hugh at LSU, dialing in from Oklahoma City, I guess listening at WRKF.org, unless we have a really strong signal today. Hugh, good morning.
Good morning, Jim. Hi, Andy. Listen, I appreciate the effort that you're putting out here.
speaking out against Jindal, I can tell you that I, too, agree that he would seem to want to be president. But guaranteed, if he is, I think we'll be joining Snowden in our desire to move in and affiliate with the USSR.
I think you're speaking a bit tongue-in-cheek, but the university crowd right now, many of whom voted for Governor Jindal, by the way, because he's smart and he's Ivy League and
young,
ethnic,
exciting.
Ethnic, yeah, they love the guy. And now what Hugh is saying is not exclusive to him.
Right.
He's speaking for a lot of people.
Well, it's
in the
pretty astounding to see Jindal's numbers drop so low so quickly. That, you know, that doesn't happen all that frequently with someone that held such promise and such hope. I don't know what will happen on the national stage. We'll see.
Did you vote for
him? I did. And here I am.
All three times?
Twice.
Twice?
Never.
Twice you voted for Governor Bobby Jindal, and I guess you probably would not vote for him if the election... another election were today.
No, but fortunately we won't be in that situation.
Well, but he'll be on the ballot for something, maybe for the U.S. Senate next year.
He says categorically no.
He says that.
We'll see.
But
we know how these things change.
Nick Saban said he wasn't going to Alabama, too. And he did. And he won 3 out of 4 national championships. So I wouldn't count Bobby Jindal out as a potential U.S. Senate candidate or certainly a potential presidential aspirant.
We'll
he could do both, by the way.
Right, and I think the speculation is that he's angling for a vice presidential nomination. Maybe that'll be the start.
Well, he's tried that a few times. He wanted to be on the ticket with John McCain. He desired to be on the ticket with Mitt Romney, and both of those gentlemen chose other people. Maybe they should have chosen Bobby Jindal. They might have.
He would have. Well,
they might have fared
this
better.
Bill might not have been vetoed if that would have happened. That would have been nice.
Well. You are speaking out in ways that quite often people don't who are in your position. You're taking a stand on an issue that is high profile that may inflame at least the governor's office.
Well, I'm not only criticizing this gubernatorial veto, but hoping that people will understand the process and think about whether we need to make changes to the Constitution to limit the power of the governor, not only this governor, but any governor that we may have in the future.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Professor Andrea
Thank
Carroll.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Maiden voyage, and hopefully we'll have her back, have Dr. Carroll back soon. Thank you. Chris Brooks steps in for just a few moments as we finish the hour, and Chris Brooks is the general manager of Dig Magazine. And Chris, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
You're headed for a busy week, aren't you?
Extremely busy. Absolutely. We're excited.
Well, what's going on this week for Chris Brooks and the staff at Dig Magazine?
All righty. This is our second restaurant week. We had our first one in January, which was a huge success. And so we were like, you know what? Let's bring it back in July. So it's this Monday through Saturday. We have over 40 participating restaurants this week. And its price ranges from $15 to $35 at, like I said, over 40 restaurants here in town. You can go to eatbr.com. All these restaurants have put together a 3-course prefix menu, a couple of appetizers, a couple of entrees, a couple of desserts for patrons to choose from. And what that regular menu price would be, they've reduced it by 25%. So the diners get a great deal. The restaurants get some business during a usually slow time of year. And at the end of the week, we're writing a check to the food bank for $5,000.
Okay. You did that 6 months ago. Must have been a success.
Absolutely.
I understand there were like 35,000 meals or something like that involved.
Correct. With the $5,000 donation, that equals to about 35,000 meals for the Greater Baton Rouge Food Bank.
All
so
right.
It's
and,
tremendous.
And WRKF, of course, is also endeavoring to assist the food bank, as you will hear more in the next few days right here on this station. But this is a worthy endeavor, and you've got so many restaurants that you can't name them all, but many of the prominent ones in this community who are involved in this.
Yeah, absolutely. The community and as a whole has, you know, we've seen a great positive response from the restaurants to the diners to all of our community partners for this endeavor. So we're super excited to bring this to Baton Rouge. And I want to remind everybody that we have our grand prize that we are choosing today at 3 p.m. You can go and register online at eatbr.com. It's a $750 value. We're going to be giving away dinner for 2 to 5 of the participating restaurants and a $250 gift card to Whole Foods. So go to eatbr.com and check it out.
All right. And this is something that's done in other parts of the country.
Oh, absolutely. I believe it started in New York City a few decades ago, and it has since grown all over the nation. Houston has one, Chicago, you know, New York. I mean, I know people that have actually traveled to Chicago for Restaurant Week. So with the, I guess, culinary gumbo that we have in this city, mm-hmm. in this state, you know, it was a no-brainer for us to do this.
6 days, right?
Correct. 6 days, Monday through Saturday.
Okay, so today through Saturday, and to have done it twice in 6 months indicates there is a market for this sort of thing. So,
I agree.
hats off to you at Dig Magazine. How's Dig doing, by the way?
Going great. Going great. Looking forward to the fall. And, yeah, we're super excited.
All right. Well, thank you, Chris Brooks. Always good to see you. We'll be back tomorrow. Until then, for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members. Thank you.